chapter 15, verse 11. And it says the grave is before God. And certainly the hearts of man. Okay? Whenever you use the word certainly, when you have a statement, like in this case you have the grave is in front of God, or God is aware of what goes on beneath the ground, that's the idea, then it's at certainly the hearts of man. So then you're saying that there is a certain degrees. There are 2 degrees, and since God could know what's doing beneath the earth, so definitely can know what's doing in the mind of man. Okay? And the question is, how could you give degrees to God? You say, because God is one. God doesn't have different qualities or different degrees. So the question is that how could King Solomon say this certainty, this certainly, this 2 levels of degrees, then about God? The degrees are in how God knows. In other words, if God knows what's doing beneath the ground, then certainly he knows what's doing in the mind of man. And the question is, how could you say that? I mean, I understand that you don't understand how God knows, or if God knows everything. But once you say God knows, you can't make a distinction in this. In other words, King Solomon is assuming that he knows everything beneath the earth, but he doesn't know what's in the mind of man. That we need a proof for. So the question is, how can he bring a proof by quantity? It seems like God has different degrees. This he could definitely see. This he can't see, which is definitely a more difficult thing. So certainly he could see that. I mean, you can't say that by God. By other things, you can have different degrees. But by God, you can't have different degrees. I am not trying to understand what the degrees are or how the degrees work. That's not my problem right now. That is a problem that I'll have to deal with. But before I could deal with that problem, I have to deal with the problem that you're saying that there's 2 levels in God's knowledge. 1 level of God's knowledge is that he certainly that one level of God's knowledge is that he could see beneath the ground. A lower level of God knowing things, you see, is in the mind of man. Now, why it's easy in the mind of man than in the ground, that's not my problem yet. I can't get to that problem until I understand how I could talk about degrees, that God has different degrees of knowing things. Now, the answer is that this verse is talking about a person that holds that God knows everything except one thing. He doesn't know what's in the mind of the human. It is with talking to a particular type of person. In other words, in reality, this guy is saying that God has a certain end that he cannot do. He cannot know what's in the mind of man, you see? But he accepts everything else about God. He accepts that God knows everything. Now, the reason why he doesn't accept that God knows what's in the mind is because emotionally he wants to have what's in his mind private. Person always feels what he thinks about is a private thing, and who he wishes to divulge it to, that's his business. But however, then therefore, if a person thinks evil or think evil thoughts, so therefore he wants to feel that nobody and nothing can know about it. So therefore, because of that emotion affects the way he views God. And even though he accepts the idea of God, that he knows everything, even that which is beneath the crust of the earth, which nobody else could know, God could know. But however, he says that the human mind he cannot know. So then what we must ask this person is, how does God know? He knows that God doesn't see, that God is not physical. We're not talking about that type of person. He accepts that God knows, but he just doesn't think about it. It's a vague thing that God knows what's going on all over. Okay? Now, so we say that however God knows, but it is with ideas that he knows about the physical. Because God doesn't see anything. God is not physical. He can't see. So somehow through ideas, God knows about the physical. Is that correct?
I guess.
Right? Now, the thing is, if God knows through ideas the physical world, he should certainly know what's on the mind of a human being, which is only ideas. In other words, we're saying that since God cannot see the physical because he is not physical, so somehow he knows the physical. He knows every aspect of the physical world. How he knows, I don't know. But the thing is that he does know. Now, if he knows the physical through ideas, he should certainly know what's on your mind, because what's on your mind is only ideas. It's only in your mind. So therefore, however he knows the physical, he should certainly know what's on your mind. Now, the question is why did King Solomon bother answering this question about some person that... there's a lot of questions that people have. Why did King Solomon bother to answer it? And that's not his style. His style is just to say the difference, the distinction between the wicked and the righteous, or the wise person and the fool. Why is he bothered to answer this question? The answer is that King Solomon is trying to teach us that when a person has an incorrect premise, if at all possible, you should try to guide him to the correct and truth via his premise. In other words, if it's possible, don't try to change his premise. First, get him to know the truth via his own premise, and then he'll see the truth, then he could see the new premise. The thing is that he holds that God knows one of his premises. The question is how did he prove it according to this person's premise? Okay, that was the question. The answer is the way he proved it was that the premise of this other person is he accepts God knows everything. But there's only a certain emotion that stops him from seeing the truth about what's going in his mind. So accepting the premise that God knows about the physical world, so once you accept that premise, then you say, based on that premise, then God must certainly know what's on your mind. You see? In other words, it's a premise that's not really thought through, but it's a premise that he accepts about God, but a certain emotion makes him stop. You see? And doesn't complete the idea. So we're taking his premise that he accepts the fact that God knows everything else. Based on that, we say, well, if he knows that, then certainly you should know what's on your mind, and we'll show it to you. The way we did, that since God knows about the physical, and how does he know? Through ideas, right? Because God doesn't see.
Okay.
So therefore, he must know ideas. Definitely he must know ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, based on the guy's premise, I showed him that he must accept this idea, the true idea.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, I say that from here you see that whenever you're trying to prove something to somebody, you should always try to prove it from his very premise to prove it, because then it'll be easier for him to accept. Verse 12, it says, God does not love... It says, the lates. The lates is a certain type of fool, okay? That's the Hebrew term. There's different types of fools that King Solomon wrote about. One of them is called the lates. Says the lates does not love any type of guidance. Anybody that guides him, he doesn't want. He says, and to the wise he does not go. And we could add, really, therefore to the wise he does not go. Okay?
Right.
Now the question that we have to ask is why does the King Solomon bother telling me he will not go to the wise? If he doesn't want guidance, he certainly won't go to the wise. Why does King Solomon have to add that? I mean, if this type of fool is a fool that does not want guidance, he certainly is not going to go to the wise, because they're going to give him guidance. So therefore, why does King Solomon have to tell me that? Right. There are two ways of answering this question. The first one is an implication, is that he does not go to the wise, but he must go to somebody else. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, who does he go to? He goes to his peers. In other words, like this. Let's say, for instance, a Republican wants a certain idea, he wants to discuss ideas. So he's going to go to another Republican. Now, even if that Republican disagrees with him, he's going to disagree with him based on the same premise that he holds. So a person is willing to go to people. What he's saying is the Leitz is a person that only goes to ask advice. It looks like he's asking advice. Look, he's an honest guy. He asks advice. But he'll ask advice of people that hold the same premise. So even if they argue with him, they're going to argue based on his premises, which that'll be happy to even change. He'll be able to deal with. But if he goes to the wise are going to deal with his basic premise and going to take away his basic premise. So therefore, he doesn't want to change his premises of life, because then he'd have to change his life around, which he doesn't want to do. So therefore, it says that to the wise he doesn't go, but people who have the same premise or the same fantasies that he has, he goes to them so that they will advise him, that even if they'll tell him to do something different, but he'll understand and relate to it because he could identify with it, because it works with the same premises. But he's not a person that could change over to get a new premise. The next possibility is that the Leitz is a very intelligent person. Let's say, for instance, a guy is a mathematician. Now, he's a very abstract thinker. But he doesn't want to see any implications that would affect his life, you see. So therefore, he would go to the wise because he enjoys a good discussion. And he would like to go and get the ideas, you see. But, however, he does not want to go because he knows that they'll show him through the ideas a different way of life or a different view of life that he doesn't want to see, even though he's studying ideas. Like, for instance, there are many, many physicists today that through the ideas of physics, especially through the Big Bang, they're starting to accept God. But there are many physicists that don't even think about it. They don't want to think about it because they don't want it to affect their lives. So therefore, they might study physics or ideas, but they don't want to view anything that will affect their life. That's why it says the Leitz, according to this interpretation, the Leitz is a very wise person. Well, he looks like a wise person. He might be a very abstract thinker. But however, I'm sorry, I used the word correct. I can't say wise. He's a very intelligent person. He's an abstract thinker. He's not wise. Because a wise person would see from the ideas, he would see that the ideas should tell him something about life and about his view of life and should change it, but that he doesn't want to see.
Okay,
the next verse says a heart that is happy, it is good, it causes his face to be gladdened, to be glad. But a sad heart, right, or a depressed heart, when a person is depressed, then he has a broken spirit, okay? Now, there is, of course, you can analyze it on the simple front, which we will analyze it in a few minutes on the simple way, but Rashi has a different type of interpretation. Now, listen carefully. Rashi says that when it says a glad heart, it means that if you gladden the heart of God, then he will cause you to have a glad face, which means he'll make you happy, right? But if you cause God to have a sad heart, right, then he will cause you to be depressed. And he brings a proof from where God saw what was happening at the time of the flood, and it says that God's heart was saddened, okay, by what he saw, and then he destroyed the, you know, through the flood. Okay?
Okay.
Now, so Rashi is saying that a person should recognize that when it says it makes God happy, God doesn't have emotions, but it means when you do the will of God, then you will be, God will make you happy. And when you don't do the will of God, then you'll you'll have a broken spirit. Now, the question is, what is this doing in Proverbs? It really doesn't belong here. It belongs in the Chumash, the five books, where God gives the curses and blessings to the Jews. He gives them the blessings and curses. That's where it belongs. The book of Proverbs is a very practical book where in everyday life a person has to investigate his immediate desires versus the long-range consequences. Okay? Now, the question is this really belongs in the book of the Chumash, where God is telling you that either you keep the commandments and you'll get blessings, or you won't keep the commandments, or you'll get curses. The question is, what is this doing in Proverbs? The answer is that the Torah holds that a person must make an evaluation about everything he does in life. He must evaluate the good and the bad, and even in the realm of Torah, and the analysis of Torah, whether you should live the life of Torah and you should analyze, even after you know, let's say, for instance, you have a proof that God gave the Torah on Mount Sinai. Even after all that, the Torah still holds that even if you know the Torah is true, you must make an evaluation and to see the benefit of the life of Torah from every different aspect. Okay, the question is why is it in this book of Proverbs? The answer is that Proverbs deals with everyday life. Anything you decide to do, you should never do anything without an evaluation of the benefits and the harm from every different angle, and after you analyze it totally, then to decide whether you should do it or not. But nothing should be done just on the spur of the moment without thought. Everything that you decide to do, no matter what, it should be done with an investigation. And what Rashi is saying now, not only in everyday life, about everyday things, but even the very religion, you might know it's the true religion. There's no doubt in your mind that it's the true religion, but you should still make an evaluation why that is still the best life than any other life that there is. In other words, it's not a matter of accepting that, I don't know if this is the greatest life, but I know I'm going to get to the world to come. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that a person must know right here, and he must evaluate the benefit in this life and in this world, that the life of Torah is better than any other life. Now, to illustrate this idea, I'd like to go to Psalms 92. Okay? And this psalm is a psalm for the Sabbath day, which means it's going to tell us something about the Sabbath. Basically, that's the first verse. Then the next five verses, up till and including verse 6, it talks about how you should recognize God's works and what God does. So I could understand, if it stopped here, that the purpose of the Sabbath is to investigate God's works and to see the greatness of God. But then it goes off on a tangent that has nothing to do with this. And it says, then the fool doesn't know. And then he says, the fool doesn't understand this. Question is, what is this? What is it? It's a pronoun. What is the noun? So according to Rashi and according to the Metzudas David and the Malbim, they hold that this, what he doesn't understand, it was follows. Okay? What follows says is that the wicked bloom like grass, and they or they flourish like grass, and they bloom and all the sinners, all the people that do acts of sins flourish to destroy them forever. Now, that is seems to be an oxymoron. They're successful to fail. That seems to be an oxymoron. Success is the opposite of failure. You're going in a different direction. Okay? So the question is, what does the verse mean that the success of the wicked is their failure? Okay? Now, the cause for success without God being involved in everyday life, the cause for success is wisdom. Okay? I one time saw a TV show about Evel Knievel and how he did a certain trick. The whole trick took maybe a minute or two, but he spent months in working it out and all the dangers and all the difficulties of it. So you see that to be successful, everything has to be worked out very, very clearly. Okay? It has to be done. Well, I mean, you can't... They say that people that do crime without thought out, even crime, I mean, it has to be worked out, and then you're going to be successful. But however, the wicked person, when he's successful, he doesn't attach it to the world of ideas. Okay? He attaches it to himself. The beginning, he might work with ideas, and he has a plan, but then slowly, as he becomes more and more successful, his egomania comes out, and he starts attaching it to himself as success, then he feels whatever he does will be successful. You see? So therefore, see, the wise person, like it says later, the wise person, his success is like a cedar. What does that mean? It means because he knows that his success is based on wisdom, and therefore he always has to make sure that before he does anything, he has to evaluate it. Now the question is, so who is this fool that doesn't know this? Okay? The fool is a person, what we're talking about, is a person that accepts the Torah and accepts truth and accepts goodness because he accepts it's good. But he still thinks, he's in conflict because he still thinks that the other people have some benefit in life. A benefit that he doesn't have. But he's willing to live the life of Torah to obey God to get a place in the world to come or to be in God's good graces. But however, when he looks at the evil people or people with fame or wealthy people with a lot of money, whatever you happen to be jealous of, so you seem to think that they have a better life than you do. Okay? So therefore, the fool is a person in conflict, and the reason why he's in conflict is because he doesn't realize that the other type of people, the people that do not live the life of Torah, does not have a good life. It's only superficially that they're successful for a short time, but then they destroy themselves, and they're not really happy. There's a lot of different ways of analyzing to show that that world that the Torah is against, it's not because the Torah is just saying that it is no good, that you shouldn't do it, but they're saying it is not a good life right here in the physical world. And therefore, the fool is in doubt about, he's in conflict. I wouldn't say he's in doubt, he's in conflict. He knows that he should live the life of Torah, but he's in conflict because he's still jealous of the other people. Now the question is, what does this have to do with the Sabbath? Okay? The answer is that the Sabbath means, it's true that the Sabbath is a day of study and relationship to God. But it represents a total commitment to God. You see? A person in conflict doesn't have a total commitment. He keeps God, but he keeps his Torah and he relates to God, but he's in conflict about it. He has a conflict. He still doesn't really... There's something... He still thinks that the other people have something that is beneficial in this world. He feels they have something that is worthwhile. Therefore, he doesn't have a commitment to the life of Torah, see, and to the ways of God. There's really a question in his mind about, where's God's goodness? Why don't I have the best life? You see? So therefore, he's the fool, even though he accepts these things, is in conflict, but it's not a total commitment. What the Sabbath represents, according to King David, is that you must make a total commitment. And a total commitment to God means that I have no doubts that the other lives, other than the true life of Torah, the other lives are of no benefit. And there's nothing to be jealous of. And if you're still jealous of them, then you really don't understand Torah, you see? And therefore, you have not made a total commitment to the world of Torah. And therefore, the only way to make a total commitment is to recognize and to go through the different lifestyles that you feel jealous of people you feel jealous of, whatever it might be, and to really see that there's really no value in that lifestyle except the lifestyle of Torah. This is what King Solomon is talking about in Proverbs, in our verse, according to Rashi's interpretation, that a person must make an evaluation of the life that he's living, and to see that no other life is equal to the life of Torah. Your religion must be not just that I accept God, and despite the fact that I have a terrible life here, I'm going to stick it out with God, but our religion demands that you must make an evaluation of the religion to see that there is no other life which is equal to the life of Torah. It's not only a matter of accepting that I'll accept God's will, even though I'm living a terrible life, but I know God will reward me in the world to come. No, you must see that the life that you are living is the best possible life that the physical world has to offer. That's what King Solomon is saying. According to Rashi, every person must do that evaluation, and the way to do it is like we showed in the Psalms, like King David showed about the Sabbath, how to do that evaluation. In other words, the evaluation that a person should do, the illustration of how to do that evaluation, is like King David showed us in the Psalms how to do that evaluation, so that we should have that total commitment to God even in the physical world. There should be no doubts about it. In other words, it shouldn't be that I know this is a terrible world for me, even though the other people are having a good world, but I'll do it because of my world to come. That is not a commitment to Torah. That illustration that King David showed is an illustration that could be used for the verse of what King Solomon said in Proverbs. There is a slight dilemma that we have here that can only be according to this idea. There's a certain dilemma. When I see this idea from Proverbs and from the Psalms, then I feel a religious obligation to make this type of investigation. Now, so therefore, what is motivating me is my religious feeling that I should make this investigation, and I do not really make a decision based on the investigation itself. It's really, in other words, whenever I make a decision, I really make it the way I always make it, according to my emotions. But however, I'm forced to make an investigation because now I see it's a religious commitment. So therefore, when I make the investigation, I only make it insofar as to satisfy my religious commitment, which King Solomon and King David told me that I have to do. But I don't really see the idea very clearly, and it's not the idea which is motivating me. In other words, since the Torah is telling us that I must make this investigation, I make the investigation, but it's a superficial investigation, and it's only an investigation to satisfy my religious emotion, but it's not an investigation of reality and a search for truth. Person has to be very, very careful of the subtlety of the difference when I feel the authority is telling me to think out something, but the thoughts is not making the decision. It is really something else. It's really my religious emotion that's making the decision, and it's even my religious emotion which makes me investigate So when I investigate, I don't truly see the reality. It doesn't allow me to for the reality to make the decision. Right. Basically, what we're saying is that the idea is that a person could do that which is correct and that which makes sense, but he's not doing it for the rational reason. He's doing it for other reasons. I'd like to give an illustration. One illustration is that when people go to college, they recognize in reality that you need college to advance insofar as your advancement in the business world, a person has to have college. But however, some people give that argument, but even if you would argue against them or you would ask questions, it does not affect them because the real reason, even though they express the words of what society says about college, that namely it's a practical thing, but however, the motive, what's motivating them is not the argument, but what's motivating them is the society that they should go to college. In other words, college is the correct thing to do. But however, some people have thought it through and evaluated the benefit of college and see what the benefit is. Some people, they might have thought it through, but what's motivating them is not the benefits of college, but they're going because the society says that you should go to college. Another illustration, which might be a little more subtle, and that is that people go to work, you see, they work for somebody else. It's not their own business, right? Person in his own business has to, is checking on every single thing. He sees the practical benefit. But sometimes when a person has a job, he just goes in to do his job, and he's doing the job to make money. Now, what happens is you'll notice that sometimes his relationship with the boss is not practical in his mind anymore. There's a certain, but not everybody, I'm just saying there are people that their relationship with their boss is not a practical relationship, but it's a relationship with authority or even a parent. Well, in other words, they make the boss like their parent, and they expect him to relate to them like a parent should relate to a child, and it becomes a different type of relationship than a very practical and a working relationship. Even though what he's doing is practical because he has to make the living, but his relationship to the situation is not based in reality, but it's based into his relationship with a parent or some authority. Versus the consequences in 10 years, 15 years. Okay? He says, even in relating to God, which is a religious act, a lot of people will not stop to really think about the benefits or harm of relating to God. They don't get involved. It's a religious thing. They don't think about it, you see. And what he's advocating, according to Rashi, what this verse is advocating, that even in your religious life, I say even the mitzvos, what the benefit is. I mean, Maimonides talks about what's the benefit of the mitzvos, what you get out of the mitzvos. Even if you don't agree, of course, you have to be careful, because once you get into the mitzvos, if you don't agree or you don't see a benefit, you're still obligated to keep it because God commanded you. And you should even keep it for these reasons. But the thing is, why you should keep it is because it's the will of God. But still in all, there should be an evaluation of the benefits of living the Torah life versus not living the Torah life, the advice of God, how God to imitate God versus not imitating God. There has to be a real, rational evaluation. It should not be accepted. There's a different relationship to God when you've gone through and made a total evaluation of it than when you just accept it. It's a different relationship. And what he's saying, and I'm saying that there are higher levels than this. There are other levels. But there must be. And Mishlei is really written for the beginner. And the beginning approach to all of life, all aspects of life, must be an evaluation of everything you do. And even in your relationship to God, it should not be done blindly, but a real evaluation to see what the benefit is and what the harm is. That's an amazing Rashi. You know, that's amazing Rashi that he says, even there you have to evaluate. This evaluation should be done after you accept the Torah. This evaluation is not whether you accept the Torah. That's a separate problem. This evaluation is done only after you accept the truth of Torah. Then you should do this evaluation. We're going to do verse 13, 14, and 15. They're all connected, one idea.
What chapter?
Chapter 15. Okay, and now we did already verse 13 according to Rashi, but now we're going according to a different interpretation, Rabbeinu Yonah, and it's a simple simple approach. It says a happy heart has a pleasant face. Literally, it's a good face, which means that it shows up on his face, has a pleasant face. But however, with a sad heart, then he has a broken spirit. Then Rabbeinu Yonah says this one point. He says that, I'll put it in my own words. There are three things that a person needs in life. A person desires pleasure. He desires pleasure, and he needs practical, like he needs to be successful practically in the practical world, and he wants happiness. Okay? Now, pleasure is a physical thing. You enjoy, I mean, on a hot day, you jump into a cold pool, you feel good. That's pleasure. But happiness is within the person. Happiness is something from within the person, and it's not from without. A lot of people think they're happy when something good happens to them, or when they're very successful. Let's say you win a $1 million prize, so you're very happy, you feel happy. That is not happiness. That's a momentary thing that passes, but that's not really happiness. Happiness is within you, that it's a certain state that you, there's really no conflict. Like you accept reality for whatever it is, and there is no conflict. That's basically happiness. Happiness is no conflict. And it's a state, it's a certain state that you're in, that you're contented. That there are things that things you just accept things for what they are. Okay?
Okay.
So this verse is saying that happiness is caused by within the person, while sadness is also from within the person, and therefore if a person is sad, then even if they have pleasures, they will not be able to enjoy the pleasure. In a time of depression, or sometimes you feel bad, you can have the greatest pleasures, and you could be depressed, you could be sad, you could be down. Okay? So happiness and sadness is basically from within the person. Now the next verse says, the heart of the wise, of a wise person, is he searches knowledge. And the mouth of the fool, and there's two interpretations, what follows. One interpretation is he thinks foolishness, or he wants foolishness. Now, what's the difference between those two possibilities? See, there are a person that thinks incorrectly, and he has incorrect desires. And a cure for a person that has this foolishness, he could either straighten out his problem through his mind and try to learn to think correctly, have correct ideas. Or he could straighten it out through his desires, through his emotions. Okay?
Person is incorrect?
Yeah, that's what it says. The mouth of the fool either thinks or desires foolishness. So I'm saying the difference in the two possibilities is, see, a fool has both. Now, if you are a person that happens to have a foolish view, you have to know that the foolish view is based on an incorrect thought and an incorrect desire. And a cure could be done. Sometimes the cure could be done by just changing your view of life. That's the simpler way. But if it cannot be cured that way, then you should get involved in the emotions and look for the source of your incorrect view of life. Now the question is, why does this verse follow the last verse? And what he's saying is one idea, and that is that the only way for happiness and or a removal of sadness is through the mind. That's why he says that the heart of the Navon is he searches knowledge. And the knowledge that he searches is really the second half of the verse. Second half of the verse is that he searches knowledge to make sure he's not a fool. He doesn't make foolish errors. He doesn't act like a fool. So therefore, he notices when he makes mistakes and he corrects it in the two ways that we just mentioned. But happiness cannot come in any other matter, according to King Solomon, except through knowledge, because knowledge affects your inner life. And since happiness is dependent on your inner life, so therefore you must have knowledge, and through your change of view, in other words, the knowledge that we're talking about, it changes your view of life. And once it changes your view of life, then you could be happy. Now the third verse says, all the days of a poor person is harsh or difficult. But however, a good heart is at a party, is constantly at a feast or at a party. So it says, even though a person is poor, if a person has a good heart or he is happy or content, then he is equal to being at a party constantly. Okay? Now the Gra or the Vilna Gaon, one of the sages that lived a few hundred years ago, he tries to explain what it means at being at a party constantly. And he says, and most of the commentaries say, that this thing that you are constantly at a party is really explaining a statement of the ethics of the fathers, which says that who is a rich man? He who is happy with his lot. Right? That's a famous statement, right? Okay. Now, so this verse is explaining that idea, and the Vilna Gaon gives explains the parable of constantly at a party. He says, when a person's at a party and he drinks wine, well, he drinks any spirits, so then at a certain point, it doesn't bother him, he doesn't worry about the king. Okay? Uses the term king. He doesn't worry about the king. It does not affect him anything about the king. Okay? But however, as soon as the wine goes away, so then he again worries, then he comes back to reality, and he's worried about the king again. Right? He says, but however, a person that's a tov lev, a good heart, or a happy person, or a person that's happy with his lot, he's like always at the party. Okay? The question is, how does that parable, the way he explained it, how does that parable explain how does it explain being always happy with your portion in life? The question is, how do you stay at that level like you're constantly at a party? What do you need to be at a constant party, even though you're really not drinking, in your natural state? In other words, that's only a parable to help explain the idea that a person can accept his portion. But we have to understand that parable. How does it work in everyday life, that I could be a person that's constantly accepting of any aspect of life?
Well,
there are two relationships with the king, okay? One is that I know one thing, I can't compete with the king. Can't compete. And two is, I'm always worried about what the king is thinking of me. The king is the person that runs the government. And what he thinks is very important to my life. And two, I know that I can't compete with him. Okay? Now, competition is always an evaluation of the self. Okay? Whenever you're in competition, it means that you're measuring yourself in terms of the other person. And when you're worried about what other people think of you, that means you're going to also make decisions based on what you want people to think of you. You're going to act in such a way, in other words, competition is you feel good when you compete with others, and you always want people to think well of you, so you'll do things in a certain way to cause people to think of you in a certain way. Now, the thing is these two things, I think, is the basis of unhappiness, because your value system and how you make decisions in life is always based on others. It's not based on your own view, but it's based on others. Either how to beat a person, how to outdo him, or I'm worried about what people think of me. You see? Now, if I could get rid of these two... See, now, when a person drinks, what he does is he removes the outside world to a certain extent. So once he removes the outside world, then he only looks at his self. His self, he's very contented. His own needs, he's very satisfied. You see? Because he doesn't feel that he failed in terms of his competition with the king or with other people. And it doesn't bother him what other people think, because he's just not involved with them. You see? So drinking removes the outside world, so therefore you only look at yourself only insofar as you are content or uncontent. Or not content. You see? So therefore, that is the person that's happy with his portion. You see? Person that's happy with his portion, he only looks at his own emotions and his own needs, what satisfies him and what doesn't. It does not matter what other people think, you see? So therefore, it doesn't matter what they think, there's no competition. That is a person that's happy with his portion. So what you have to do is remove this relative value system, that everything is relative to others. It's only your value system is based on your relationship to others. That has to be removed. And then you just look at what your needs are. Once you see what your needs are, so then usually your needs, if you don't have I'm including in competition jealousy also. If you don't have jealousy, competition, and you don't worry about what people think of you, is usually very, very little. You can be satisfied even if you're a poor person. Basically, you'll be satisfied with your life. You'll be a happy person. You're contented with very little. We are not saying that a person should not look externally outside themselves. I mean, you have to view life and analyze life and get a view of life, but you should not. But your value system should not be based on your relationship to people. Your value system should be an objective value system that you evaluate, and then you become content with that value system and with your needs. But what you have to remove is the relative value system, which is relative to other people and is dependent on other people. Once you do that, basically you could have a very, very good life. There's not much... The reason why people want a lot and have to do so much in life is for three things: jealousy, competition, and what people are going to think about them, what the Joneses are going to think about them. The external world is for practicality and pleasure and for analysis of studying and trying to see God in the universe and to see ideas. That's the externals. But definitely not for happiness. In other words, the externals is an important part of life, but not for happiness. For happiness, that's totally your view of life. Your view of life brings happiness. And what you must undo is the relative value system. We're in chapter 15, and we're going to do verse 16. Okay? And it says, better with a little, or better with less, with the fear of the Lord, than a great treasure and screaming in it. Okay? By screaming in it means that according to Rashi, it means where people are complaining because he stole from them and caused them to have great losses by stealing, and so people are complaining or taking him to court. Okay, that's basically the verse. In other words, the way he got the treasure was through stealing, and because of that, there are people complaining. Okay? Now, the first question that I'd like to ask is, why does it say the fear of the Lord? It shouldn't say the fear of the Lord. It should say that he doesn't want screaming. He doesn't want the consequence. And two, screaming, let's say, for instance, these people that steal, I mean, they don't care that people complain. They don't care who they hurt. It doesn't bother them. It doesn't bother that they're complaining. The only thing he cares about is the loss. So therefore, why did it say the consequences is that he loses money? But that they're screaming on him is no great loss. I'll read the verse again. It says it's better with less, which means less money, with the fear of the Lord, to have fear of God, in other words, do things honestly, than to have a great treasure and people yelling at you. Why are they yelling? So according to Rashi says it's because you got your treasures and you got your great wealth through stealing and robbery. And therefore, people are angry with you. And therefore, they're complaining at you or taking you to court or all these different, different complaints. Now, the question is, what does that have to do with the fear of the Lord, the opposite? And two is that what's the big consequence of people arguing with you? The type of person that steals, most of the time, they don't care. They don't care that people scream at them. They don't need a lot of friends. All they care about is their money. So the only thing that they do care is if they're going to lose their money. So therefore, the verse should say, the consequences is that he'll lose all his money, which sometimes the verses do show. So the question is, what is he saying? What's the consequence? Okay. Now, by fear of the Lord means... You see, fear of the Lord means a person, in this case, it has to mean he's talking about a man of justice. Okay? That's what it means, fear of the Lord. That he recognizes justice. Okay? Now the question is, what is the benefit of being just? In other words, they're sometimes looking at it that I'm just because of God. Okay? But over here, I can't do that. You understand? Because it wouldn't make a comparison to the other side. Here it means that I have fear of the Lord means that I'm a just person. I'm a person in society that keeps the system, that keeps a just system. Okay? Now the question is, what is the benefit of a just system? What is the benefit of keeping a just system? Now the answer to that is that you have to look at what is the benefit of a society. In other words, when we say justice, we say that you should maintain the society. And therefore, to maintain the society, there must be some benefit in society. Okay? So, the thing is that the question is, what is the benefit of society? I'd like to mention a few benefits. Okay? First benefit is there's the Gemara, Talmud, that says that the that one of the sages say that Adam, for him to if Adam had to raise the sheep, had to shear the sheep, had to clean the wool, make it into wool, and then make the wool into clothing, then he had clothing. He says, well, I got it at a store and pull it off the rack. He says Adam had to plow the ground, sow the ground, and then raise the, make sure it grows well, removing the weeds. Then he had to cut it. Then he had to grind it. Then he had to make it into flour, and then he was able to make bread. He says, well, I got it at a store, and I have the bread made. So the benefit of a society is that you have a much, much better life, an easier life, because everybody does their job, and if everybody does their job, so then there's a big gain. You understand? So then you have a certain amount of time for yourself. You have things easier. The other thing that is best to benefit to society is they have a police force that protects you from criminals, that people that turn criminal in the society. You have an army that protects you from foreign nations, so they give you a certain amount of protection. In a just society, if something goes wrong or you become unhealthy, they'll take care of you. They'll if you get old, you can't work, they'll take care of you. So therefore, there are many more benefits to society, to having a society. Okay? Now, on the other hand, there's a benefit for a person to be independent, and that he should create on his own and work on his own, and feel that there's a certain feeling that I worked and I made my own living and I developed and I'm an independent person. Okay? Because a person needs that too. So it's saying like this, it is better to have more, to recognize the need of society, and even though you make less money because you're involved in society, you have to do things in a just way, so you make less, so it comes out you might make less, but because you're going to have a just society, so therefore it's a good thing. Because you must have the just society, and you have a little bit, which means you were independent and you worked on your own and you made your money. Then you should be totally, then to think that you're totally self-sufficient. See, that would be incorrect. Where a person feels that I'm independent, I don't need anybody else. Just I'll make $1 million, I don't need anybody. I'm totally my own man. That is totally against reality. That is a destruction of the society. That's what it means. People are screaming against them. It means it's a breakdown of the society. You see? And there's another mistake he's making. He thinks that if he could be evil, then other people are going to learn from him. They're going to want to take vengeance. And so therefore, it's going to cause a society of evil. He's not going to even realize. He doesn't realize that he himself is destroying himself. Because he's, in other words, when it's saying that people will scream at him, he's breaking down society. And therefore he will suffer the consequences of not having a society. That's what it's saying. It's saying he's suffering the consequences that if it continues this way, he'll break down the society. And if he breaks down the society, he'll have nothing. His need for being totally independent and for saying, I don't have to depend on anybody else, he'll break down society and then he'll have a real loss. He'll totally destroy himself. He'll totally destroy himself in one of two ways. Either he won't have the benefits of society, or the society, he won't have any protection of society, and it will be destroyed by the society, by the people, because there's no society to protect them. Right, we're still chapter 15, verse 17. And it says that it's better a meal of vegetables and love is there than a fatted ox and hatred is with it. We're going to do four different interpretations on this verse. Okay? The first one is that it's the word for a meal here, according to the Meiri, It means a usual meal, like, for instance, a meal you have every day. Okay? Which means that it's the people that you're usually with. Okay? Friends. Okay? Now the thing is that the question is like this. If you love somebody, which means doesn't mean love in the sense of love, it means you like somebody, you're friendly with them, you want to be friends with them, you are friends with them. You know what I mean? So the thing is, the question is, on what basis do you choose your friends? Okay? When it says that you have a meal and there's hatred there, what do you mean? You invite people that you hate? A person doesn't invite people they hate. They invite people they like. So wherein lies the hatred? Who did you invite to your meal? And especially according to the Miri that says it's on a regular basis. So then who is this friend that you have? Who is let's put it this way. Who is the enemy that you're constantly inviting to your table? The thing is that friendships are made based on superficial things. Like, for instance, they fit in society. You know what I mean? Like society people, so they're only friendly with those people in their society. They choose them by superficial things, whatever constitutes their society. Okay?
You mean like
yeah, in other words, like upper crust or middle class.
Yeah.
Or you might choose friends that are sports, that are into sports. Right? You always invite them over. Or you're interested in business, so you only invite business people over. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, all these people, even though they have something in common, but also among these people, there's usually also competition and jealousies. And the proof of this is that you always notice that they always talk gossip about each other. Or they're trying to beat each other. If they're sportsmen, they're all trying to beat each other. You know what I mean? So they're betting on whose team is better. You know what I mean? And sometimes the competition gets severe. You see? So the thing is, competition and jealousy is really a hatred for the other person. It causes a hatred. And so therefore, because of this, that's what he means. So sometimes there's a superficial way of making friends, he says, but if that is so, then what's going to happen? You have to realize there's hatred underneath. There's anger. But however, where two people are truly friends, where they relate to the soul of the other person, because the guy, they look for goodness in another person. In other words, a person where they don't sense these negative emotions. So then, that's a true friend. See, people are looking for superficial things, like, for instance, where you get a big meal where at a wedding, a bar mitzvah, they serve unbelievable food. That's what it says here, fatted ox. And they look, wow, that's really special. I'd like to be friendly with that guy. You know, he's a good guy. But a guy that just has a meal of vegetables doesn't look too good, right? But the truth is, it could be that that guy is a true friend. And there's no real competition, he's not jealous, and he's happy for you, whatever you have.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, it might be better off with him than with anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Okay?
The next interpretation of this verse is that it says that it's better to have a meal of vegetables, and there's love there. Now, you notice it doesn't say love for who. So the next possibility is really a love of the self. What a love of the self means, it doesn't mean like an egomaniac, you know. It means that a person that accepts himself for who he is and for what he is. But there's certain people that do not accept themselves for what they are. They're usually extremely jealous. That's what causes jealousy, is because you're not satisfied with yourself, so you think the other person has it better. And so therefore, it's because jealousy is a result of not being content with your own life. So you're always looking at others and it seems, boy, they have it better. But if you are content, you wouldn't have to look at others. You see? So he's saying that sometimes a person a person strives, certain people strive for the wealth, for the outer things that seem to make greatness, a show. You understand? So the thing is they drive for that, but they're very unhappy. There's a discontent with the self, like practically a hatred of the self. You see? It's better to sometimes not to run for the money, but to spend time in undoing this and to learn to accept yourself. You're better off with that and just have a very little, even very little. It's not a lot. But the other person is running for the lot. He's running for big gains in all areas of the materialistic. The third interpretation, the Meiri quotes from our sages, and he says like this. He says it's talking about giving to a poor person. He says it's better a meal of vegetables, and there's love there when he gives it, than a fatted ox, when he gives the fatted ox to the poor, and there's hatred there. Okay?
We're talking about him. Somebody giving food.
This third interpretation is where a person is giving to the poor, and there's two ways of giving to the poor, and he brings a story, but the story is not by the poor. The story is by honoring your father and mother. He says there are certain people that they give their father really a healthy thing, and they will go down. They will they're really evil, right? And there's some. In other words, there's some people that serve their father. Let me give the illustration. This thing is an illustration. It says, let's say, for instance, a certain person gives his father, serves his father. The illustration here is. Certain type of duck, certain type of fowl, that's really very expensive. And when he gave it to him, his father said to him, how did you get this thing? How did you get it? So he said to his father, he says, old man, eat and don't talk so much. Basically, that's what it's saying. It's more metaphorical, but he's saying don't be friendly, just eat. See, that's a guy. He's serving his father a delicious meal, but when he speaks to him, in a disgusting manner. Okay, but there was another guy that he was working the grindstones. The son had a business. He's working the grindstones, and soldiers many times would come by to take the food for the army. And one time the soldiers came by, so the son told the father, he says, you work behind the grindstone so you won't be around, and if they degrade anybody or they hit me, you know what I mean, because there were soldiers, he says, it's better me than you. So here he's making his father work by the grindstone, but yet that's real honor of the father. You see, he's protecting him. Okay? And there's another in the Talmud in Bava Basra. It says that if you give a penny or money to a poor person, you get six blessings. But if you comfort him, Then you have 11 blessings. Okay? The question is, what are the two stories? What do they have in common? In other words, there is a person that wants to give charity, but have absolutely no relationship with the poor person. He has an obligation. He gives it. He says, "Look, don't bother with me. Here's your money. Go. Goodbye." Or he actually degrades him. Like with the father, puts him down. Okay, that is, if you give charity, without being involved with the person, that is one level of charity. There's a second level of charity where you're involved with the person. In other words, you know his psychological needs. And you try to comfort him and to deal with his psychology. You deal with him as a human being, not as an object that just to give charity to. You see? Or sometimes there's a man, like for instance with the son having the father work the grindstone, sometimes you might have to, you're forced to do something to protect the person, which you need a little thought based on the situation, what's a real protection or what's a real help to the other person.
Mm-hmm.
You see, that takes a certain amount of thought. When you deal with the person as a whole, or sometimes you have to evaluate the situation, that's really charity. That's what it means, charity, where you give him just a little bit, but there's love there. By love means you take in consideration the situation, and you take in consideration his personality, what his needs are. That's love. But if you just give him an ox and you don't look at the whole situation, or you give him a big meal and you degrade him, you know what I mean, or you don't take in consideration his psychological needs, then that is not love. That's your giving, but it's not even a good thing. You're not even doing a good thing. Is actually, that's what he says, the verse is saying, that it's actually hatred there. And the fourth explanation is Rashi, okay? Rashi says that there was a sacrifice that the poor gave that was like a very, very little, which is represented in this verse by the vegetables. And then sometimes a person would sin, and he would bring a big ox, you know what I mean, for a sin offering, right? So he says it's better to relate to God sincerely with a little bit, where you love God, you see, and you give a little bit, than to give an ox, but you really, it's like an obligation, you're just fulfilling an obligation. But you don't really, it's not because of the love of God, or like a person would give a charity so that people should recognize him. That's not a love of God. You're not doing it because of God. So there's a certain hatred of God. You're turning away from God. You're not doing it because of God. You're doing it for totally other reasons. You see? So that is the fourth interpretation of the verse. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now all these four interpretations have something all in common. Okay, and that is the world looks at things superficially. How to choose a friend? They look at superficial things. What they think is important for themselves. Success and the gen. They try to be successful only because they're jealous of others, and. There's another superficiality, charity. You know what I mean? They think the more you give, that's better. You know, just the more. It's a very superficial view. And also with God, a lot of people relate to God in a very, very superficial manner. But however, the thing is that is that there must be a deeper view of looking at things. In other words, when you choose a friend, you have to look at the depths if the guy is really a competitive, if he's a, he could hurt you if he want, you know what I mean? If he's a real friend, would he stick by you in real trouble? Or only when you have wealth? I mean, these are the type of things you have to look for. The same thing in yourself. What's important about yourself? Is it success and beating others? Or is the important thing about yourself is to be happy? To accept yourself for what you are, to accept your situation. Same thing with charity. And the same thing with God. The Meiri, the interpretations of the three first, the three interpretations of the Meiri, is the first one was his own. The second one he quotes somebody else. He doesn't say from who. And the third interpretation was the sages he got from the different areas of Talmud. Okay, verse 18. An angry man stirs up quarrels, and a person that takes long to is long to anger, he quiets quarrels. He it's better. He quells quarrels. Okay? All right. Now, the first question that we have to know is, who is an angry man? What is the nature of an angry man? Right? There are certain times, there are certain situations which cause you anger. Okay? That's not an angry man. An angry man has within him a emotional anger. Built in within him is a anger. Like I say, just say it's like a, when his anger comes through, it's like a dam breaking. You see, you sense that angry person, right? It's just, he's just looking for a fight. He has a tremendous amount of anger, and he's just looking for a situation to let it all out in. See, a regular person is, if you start up with him, so he'll get angry. You see? But the angry person is, he's looking for a fight. Okay? Now, the thing is that he starts quarrels, meaning that the guy that he starts with is the second type. Okay, he's the type of person that he would not start a quarrel. But if somebody starts with him, it'll awaken his anger, and he'll get involved into the fight too. Right? Now the question is, that person, why does he get angry? What causes him to get angry?
The second.
In other words, the first person, the angry person, he starts out, he has anger. Now, there's another person that might not have that anger, but he could start a fight. He'll do something to start a fight. Now, that means the second guy who he started with will get angry and start a fight back. And he'll really get into the fray, right? Now, the thing is, why does the second guy get angry? Since, in other words, he doesn't have that much anger in him, you know what I mean? So what causes him to lose it at this point? When the other guy starts up with him. Okay, there are two possible reasons. One is ego. He hits him in his ego, and once your ego is hurt, so then you have to protect your ego. Okay? But there is another reason, and that is security. Okay? That is, a person has a need security, and when he gets insecure, or if somebody takes away that security, he gets very angry. I'll give you a distant illustration. Let's say, for instance, you have you're at war, right? And you have the enemy, and you know the feeling of hating the enemy, right? Right. But however, let's say, for instance, one of your own turns traitor to the other side. Now, is that hatred? That hatred should be equal to the enemy, because they became the enemy. But you'll always notice the hatred for a traitor is terrible. And even the side that he turned to, those people also dislike a traitor. And the question is, why? Like Benedict Arnold, I mean, when he went to England, he was never really accepted. They didn't like him there. You know? Why? Because he was a traitor. Okay? Now, the question is, why is a traitor hated worse than the enemy? Right, so the answer is that, you see, when you have an enemy, so you realize who he is, and you understand that you have to deal with him. But when you have a friend, you feel secure. There's a certain security that you have. An enemy, when you face an enemy, there is insecurity. Okay? Right. But however, let's say your friend becomes your enemy. So first you had security, and he took that security away in the sense that now I don't know who to trust. Can I ever trust a friend? Well, even if I do, it's not with the same trust that I had before. So therefore, the traitor or the friend that turns as an enemy makes me terribly, terribly insecure. Greater insecurity than a person that I knew all along was an enemy. You see? And also, a angry person is going to start a fight over a little thing. It's not going to be a real thing because he's looking for a fight. Okay? Now, the thing is, a thing like that in your mind should not start a fight. Like, you feel that you didn't do anything wrong because it's such a small matter. Even if it's something awful, even if you did something off, it does not deserve that anger that the angry man is going to do, what is going to be awakened, and what he's going to try to start a fight here. So therefore, that also gives you insecurity. So the thing is, the insecurity could be caused by many things. It could be a friend that suddenly turned on you. It could be a very small thing, or a situation where you're not expecting a fight, you didn't do anything, you see? So therefore, all those situations give you insecurity, you see? So once you have that insecurity, so that continues the fight, which the angry man is happy because that's what he wanted to do anyway. You see? And that's how the fight escalates into an actual quarrel and, you know, could be really bad. Okay? Now, the thing is with the person that can contain himself, he's a person that either has a good ego, so when you attack him, he has a healthy ego, so if you attack him, he doesn't feel broken, or he's very secure, so when you attack him, he doesn't feel that insecurity. So therefore, he doesn't react. You see? Now even an angry person that has a tremendous amount of anger has to attach it to something. Okay? So when the person doesn't react to his anger, he can't attach his anger to anything in reality because the other guy doesn't see anything to quarrel about. And especially he's not getting angry, so therefore the other guy doesn't get angry, so he says there's nothing wrong here. So therefore, since there's nothing wrong, even the angry man doesn't have an outlet. So he has to quit the argument at some point. The road of the lazy person is like a thorn, like gate of thorns, like it's thorns, totally full of thorns. And the path of the righteous is smooth. Okay? The question is, the opposite of lazy is not righteous. Or is, right? The opposite of lazy would be energetic. And the question is, there's not opposites, okay? And the answer is like this. The thing is, we're talking about the path of the lazy and the path of the righteous, which means we're not talking about results but how they relate to means to an end. Like a person has to go to work to make a living, has to go to school to get a degree. Okay? These are all means to an end. Okay? Now he says these means to the lazy person is total pain, total torture. While to the intelligent person, to the wise person, it's smooth. Okay? The question is, what's the difference? Okay? Now, the lazy person, in his mind, see, usually the lazy person wants the results. It's the type of person that wants the results, but he wants to skip the means. Okay? Which means that in his mind, there are two things. In reality, he knows that he needs the means. But emotionally, unconsciously, he feels that he really should get. It is really, let's put it this way, it's unjust to for him to do the means. He should just have the results. That's only right and correct of this world to give him results without the means. Okay? So therefore, when he works, he's in terrible conflict because he feels this shouldn't be happening, and it's not fair that it is happening. So whenever he's working, he's always in that conflict. You see? But an intelligent person who accepts reality for what it is, he would not do the means if he didn't want the result, but he accepts reality that he has to do this means to get it. So since he accepts reality, he's not in that conflict. So since he's not in that conflict, so the road is a smooth one to where he is going.